Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and Stephanie, I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update from the 2012 American Society of Hematology ASH Annual Meeting. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 857 participants on the call today and from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Bangladesh, India, Ireland, Italy, Kenya, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, this program has been made possible by a charitable contribution from Teva Oncology and Friends of Cancer Care. And I really want to thank Teva Oncology for their support of our program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about all of our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to please complete that evaluation form. You know, your feedback is really very important to us as we plan all of our future programs for 2013. So please do tell us what you think of the program, topics you'd like us to offer, and we will try very hard to implement those topics. Indeed, this has become an annual topic for us because of your request that we do this program. We have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute, Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of blood cancers. He's going to present new research presented to ASH on leukemia, disease-specific treatment updates, and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thank you, and thank you all for listening in and tuning in today. It's a pleasure to join you and talk about some of the exciting news we heard at the ASH meeting and really throughout the year. With regards to leukemia. If you know me, you might know that I'm someone who focuses a lot on chronic myeloid leukemia, so I wanted to certainly cover some exciting new approvals and updates we have there, but I'll also go through some of the other updates in other leukemias. To start with, the first task is to talking to your healthcare provider about treatment options. I certainly want to encourage all patients to have a completely open dialogue and not to be shy about asking for multiple opinions and to be provocative with your healthcare team. We're there to answer your questions, to negotiate with you what is the best treatment plan, to cover all the range of options, not to choose for you, but to choose with you. There's a lot of different areas of research. We shouldn't be shy about, we should be humbled and understand if there's a question or something that we haven't seen, please bring it to us and we'll do some research. We'll of course want to share with patients and their families as much information as possible. Sometimes it can take even more than one consultation. It's always good to take a friend or a family member with you as a sounding board, as a second person to listen in, to take notes. And thank goodness it's 2013, the electronic age, we have much better communications, even including electronic communications between our healthcare team and our patients and families, so we can really effectively communicate our treatment plans and decide on them a lot better. So I encourage you all to be as current and as proactive as possible to engage on your healthcare team and to ask for a team within your own group. A friend or family member is essential often for consultations. So on to leukemia in 2012 and particularly in ASH. So with CML first, we certainly saw a lot of exciting news with CML in 2012. We saw in the end of 2012 two additional drugs approved for Ph-positive leukemias. The first was a drug called bosutinib, which goes by the brand name Bosulif, and the second a drug named panantinib, which goes by the brand name Iclusig. So now in 2013, we have five drugs in the same genre, in the same family of what are called kinase inhibitors, which are oral, once or twice a day drugs with moderate toxicity, which are effective as initial treatments for early stages of Ph-positive leukemia called chronic phase CML. The newer drugs have been mainly focused on second and third treatments with patients who don't have response or have side effects with their initial treatment choice. And we even have with ponantinib a drug which is able to affect response when multiple drugs have not served a patient well and specific types of resistance have developed, particularly select mutations. Results from ponantinib in a phase 2 trial called the PACE trial presented at ASH, an update of with nearly a year of follow-up, and the results are very encouraging with a majority of patients, an overwhelming majority of patients with chronic stage CML bringing back or gaining blood remission, a good majority of patients gaining bone marrow cytogenetic remission, and an increasing number of patients achieving what's called a molecular remission, a much safer place to be and likely to translate into long-term success. Ponantinib is also active in patients with advanced forms of Ph-positive leukemia. And it's important to note when you look at these studies, that these folks had a lot of treatment and multiple lines of treatment. So when the leukemia is more active, more proliferative in advanced phase, such response rates are incredibly encouraging. This drug was FDA approved, is now prescribable. So we have a broad armamentarium in CML. In addition, from CML, I think probably the most covered topic at ASH was that early monitoring of response in CML is essential and really helps us understand how someone's doing and how to choose and how to navigate through these five different therapies in essence. When someone starts on treatment within 3 months, by simple blood-based testing, by PCR-based testing, we can tell if the level of leukemia is measured by something called the BCR-ABL level, the BCR-ABL transcript level, if it's falling adequately, that someone may be doing just fine and can stay on their current therapy. But we can also see early signs that another treatment might be better off to serve the patient and get them into deeper cytogenetic and molecular remission, rather than waiting until the CML perhaps has shown us that it can relapse or, heaven forbid, progress. So with early monitoring, we can intervene early and identify the, fortunately, small number of people who don't have good early response and who can move on to other therapies. And again, the spectrum is quite broad. Thinking about other leukemias, I'd like to continue on the theme of targeted therapy and then turn to AML. At ASH, we saw several topics, but just a few to mention would be that an older medication called gentuzumab, which is an antibody against an antigen or a protein on leukemia cells, which is very smartly connected to a toxin which gets into leukemia cells and kills them, had previously been approved and then it had been withdrawn, but a new study has shown that perhaps if we use it differently, if we use lower doses and spread the doses out, that we really can improve the response rates with chemotherapy and even the survival of patients treated with AML. And this may lead to a revival of this drug. So even medications that we have studied and perhaps were more encouraged and less encouraged, we may see them come back as we study them more smartly and more carefully. There are multiple agents for specific subsets of leukemia, particularly those bearing something called the FLT3 marker. And time does not permit me to cover all of them. And then lastly, in AML, we saw continued research into just a newer way of giving our standard drugs called cytarabine and daunorubicin, particularly a drug called CPX351, which packages the chemotherapy in the right concentration into a package called a liposome, which is more efficiently delivered to leukemia cells. And we believe we stumbled upon a better way to give our medications we've been giving for a long time now, which have proven efficacy and can probably extend our results just by changing the way we deliver the drug. We saw, regarding a subset of AML, a diagnosis called APL, a very specific form of leukemia, but one that's quite exciting that it responds well to targeted therapy, that we may be able to abandon the need of using what are called conventional or cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs. We saw a presentation in what's called the plenary session, which is the most important abstract that the meeting organizers felt, where a combination of two targeted drugs, one all trans retinoic acid, which is an oral medication with a moderate side effect profile, and a second drug, arsenic trioxide, which sounds a little unnerving if you hear that first word arsenic, but it's actually a very safe and very effective therapeutic in this disease and also multiple myeloma, which we're going to hear about in a bit. But the combination of all trans retinoic acid and arsenic trioxide was was equally effective in comparison to all trans-retinoacetine chemotherapy in patients with lower risk APL. I think this was an important finding and really moving us ahead towards a non-chemotherapy approach to the subset of leukemia, which means lower side effects and very high response rates. We're talking nearly almost 100% of both groups responded to these regimens, so this is very promising. With regards to ALL, or acute lymphocytic leukemia, we're beginning to see more and more antibody therapies develop, particularly, to describe them, an antibody called inotuzumab, which is an antibody like the antibody gentuzumab I described in AML. This one is against a target on an ALL cell, also coupled to a toxin called calicheamycin, and that antibody is working its way in and helping patients prior to transplant, and in combination with chemotherapy might be, just like what we see in AML, a way to boost our response rates with chemotherapy. Second antibody that got a bit of attention at ASH and has through the last few months of other meetings is called blinatumomab. These have great names, but this one has a short abbreviated name called a BiTE antibody, which means it's bispecific. It's an engineered antibody that essentially marries recognizing a cancer cell, an ALL cell, and also a T cell, which is an immune cell, which actually helps delete or kill the leukemia cell. So it harnesses our own immune system to help clear leukemia cells from the blood. It's a very novel concept and, again, showing promise in this disease. I'd like to just close with something that might be covered with my colleagues. And one of the most exciting stories around ASH and before ASH was a work from investigators in the East Coast, Dr. Carl June, where T cells have been engineered using an element that allows them to enter into T cells that's actually adapted from viral infections that we know quite a bit about. And these T cells are then essentially energized to seek and destroy leukemia cells. So it's called a chimeric antigen receptor T cell. And it is a very exciting advance in leukemia and is showing great promise. And there's an incredible amount of energy around our ability to potentially use non-chemotherapy, much like some of the other things I mentioned, as ways to treat leukemia. And this approach has shown particular success in CLL. I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd like to turn the rest of the program over to my colleagues. We're going to share much more exciting updates.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrow, for really starting this off, really this very ambitious program to cover the major blood cancers, and you're starting with talking about leukemia, and thank you for the very extensive and comprehensive review of updates from ASH. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. William Bensinger. Dr. Bensinger is professor of medicine, University of Washington. He's director of autologous stem cell transplant program, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Bensinger is going to address new research presented at ASH on multiple myeloma, disease-specific treatment updates, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Bensinger.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure to be here and a privilege to be able to talk to all of you. I know that there's a tremendous amount of interest in multiple myeloma. Myeloma has really represented one of the, I think, models for new drug development, and as a result of that, we have made significant progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma, and in the last few years, survival has improved for patients with myeloma by several years. There were two old classes of drugs. I call them old now, but they're not really. There was improvement in proteasome inhibitors. Now, proteasome inhibitors, the first in class was the drug bortezomib, or as most of you know it, Velcade, which has been a very important drug in the treatment of multiple myeloma. But two new drugs have been developed in the last couple of years, carfilzomib, which is a second-generation proteasome inhibitor, and has some significant advantages. The main one is it has a very low signal of peripheral neuropathy. This drug was approved by the FDA last summer and is now commercially available. It's also known by the brand name of Kyprolis. Another drug, MLN9708, which is an oral proteasome inhibitor. So it's the first time we have an oral drug in this class. This was also been developed over several years, and there are several trials that I'll highlight in a minute. In the second class of drugs which we've made progress are the immunomodulatory drugs. These are the drugs thalidomide and lenalidomide. pomalidomide or Revlimid, and now we have a third drug known as pomalidomide, which, although it's not approved, is likely to be approved in the next 1 to 2 months and will become available. And then the third class of drugs, which is fairly new in this field, are monoclonal antibodies. As many of you are aware, there's been huge progress, as Dr. Morrow has pointed out, in the use of antibodies in leukemias. We have a long-standing history of the excellent drug rituximab, which has changed the way we treat lymphomas. And now, for the first time, we have several drugs that look promising that are monoclonal antibodies. So first off, carfilzomib, which is this drug that was FDA approved. It's been approved for patients who failed bortezomib and failed an immunomodulatory drug. This was reported by a group that combined this drug as initial therapy for newly diagnosed patients. And they combined carfilzomib with several older drugs, cyclophosphamide and thalidomide and dexamethasone. Now, they chose thalidomide for primarily economic reasons. While thalidomide is not used as much in the United States, it's really the only drug that's readily available in this class outside the U.S. Lenalidomide, surprisingly, is not widely available in Europe or other countries. It hasn't gotten the proper approval to be available. But this four-drug combination was used to treat 38 patients with myeloma. They saw a tremendous overall response rate of 96%. 74% of these patients achieved what we call a VGPR, which is a 90% reduction in the monoclonal protein. So this is quite a tremendous response rate with this four-drug regimen. It was not without side effects. There were some adverse events associated with it, and about 16% of patients did require a dose reduction. But this trial is continuing, and I think we'll have updates of this in the future. Now, the other proteasome inhibitor, MLN9708, which is an oral form, essentially, of bortezomib, has shown promise in the treatment of multiple myeloma. As monotherapy, it has around a 20 to 25% response rate, but it was reported at ASH this year that it was combined with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, so the second-generation immunomodulatory drug and dexamethasone. This oral drug was combined, and the treatment with the drug was simply once a week, 3 weeks out of four. So a cycle was a month, 28 days, and weekly MLN9708 for three of the 4 weeks, along with the typical 21 days of lenalidomide and weekly dexamethasone. And these were patients who were newly diagnosed and untreated, and they saw about a 92% response rate with this, with a very good partial response rate of 55%. And it did have, as the other drugs do, it had side effects. There was a rash and fatigue, some nausea, and GI difficulties that could either be diarrhea or constipation. There was some peripheral neuropathy, although there is a sense that there's less peripheral neuropathy with the oral form than with the intravenous or parenteral administration of bortezomib. About 7 patients out of 65 did have to discontinue treatment due to adverse events. What's nice about this is it's an entirely oral drug formulation. So you have 3 drugs combined, all of which can be given orally. And this is one of the newer combinations like this. There is a trial ongoing in a relapsed refractory setting and a second trial that is planned in newly diagnosed patients. These are phase 3 or so-called randomized studies where they'll compare the 3-drug regimen to the 2 drugs, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. And these are going to be important trials. Now, in the relapse setting, as I mentioned, one of the more exciting developments is the use of monoclonal antibodies. The first such drug is elotuzumab. This is a monoclonal antibody directed against a protein known as CS1 This is expressed almost exclusively in myeloma cells and plasma cells. It has a very, very low amount of expression on certain T cells, but otherwise is not expressed in other tissues. And this is important because it avoids what are called off-target toxicities, so it's not associated with unacceptable toxicities because the antibody is targeting other cells. This was combined with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And so this is a combination of elotuzumab with these other two drugs. And this was in a relapsed or refractory setting. And they saw an overall response rate of 92%. Now, this is remarkable because you'd expect for a similar population, if you treated them just with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, you would expect a response rate in the range of 50 to 60%. So this is at least 30% higher. The other impressive thing about these results are that the durations of response have been quite long. With about a 21-month follow-up period, the median progression-free survival, which is the percentage of patients that stay in response, had not been reached. So more than half of the patients by 21 months were still responding to therapy. It did have some side effects, some anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, and diarrhea, but in general was acceptable and well-tolerated. Now, there is, again, a phase 3 trial that's ongoing looking at this drug in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Another antibody that's very exciting is called daratumumab, which is an anti-CD38 antibody. This is a protein that's highly expressed in plasma cells and myeloma cells. And this trial was reported out of the Nordic countries, and they saw about a 20% response rate with just the antibody itself, which is very good activity for patients who failed other therapies. That's all that's been reported, but I think you're going to see a lot more with this antibody in the coming years. Now, the other drug that I mentioned that's under development is pomalidomide. This is a third-generation immunomodulatory drug, so it's a drug after lenalidomide. It's more potent, and the dosage is much, much lower. So instead of a typical 15 to 25 milligram dose for lenalidomide, the typical dosing of pomalidomide is only 2 to 4 milligrams. There was one important study that was reported by a European consortium in which they took patients who had failed both bortezomib and lenalidomide, and they were randomly assigned to a combination of pomalidomide and low-dose dex, or the weekly dex, and 4 milligrams of pomalidomide, or they received pulse high-dose dex. And these patients were treated until disease progression or unacceptable toxicity. And keep in mind, these patients had failed most of the other therapies, including the new drugs. They saw about a 21% response rate with the combination. This was much higher than the just the dex group, where only 3% responded. But they saw a doubling of the progression-free survival from 1.8 months to 3.6 months. So this was improved. And there was also improved, quite a significant improvement in overall survival. They did see some side effects of neutropenia, anemia, and infections, but in general it was well tolerated. And this drug, when it becomes available, is going to be a very exciting new drug that will be around for patients who've had prior treatment and not responded to lenalidomide and bortezomib. I should mention that pomalidomide has also been combined with several other drugs. There was a trial reported combining the new proteasome inhibitor carfilzomib with pomalidomide and dexamethasone. There was also a trial combining clarithromycin with pomalidomide and dexamethasone. Now, clarithromycin is a antibiotic, and it's not entirely clear why it potentiates the effect of the immunomodulatory drugs. It's thought that it might affect the metabolism of the drugs and keep a higher blood level around in patients who get the drug. It's been used successfully for both thalidomide and for lenalidomide, but it was also reported combining the three drugs. And then finally, pomalidomide was also combined with cyclophosphamide in an oral dosing with prednisone. And the cyclophosphamide and prednisone were given on every other day schedules with the pomalidomide. All of these trials showed about 50 to 55% response rates. The progression-free survivals were longer than you would expect with the pomalidomide dex that I reported earlier. And so these are new combinations that I think are going to be very exciting. And then finally, I just want to stress the importance of clinical trials. Virtually all of the new drugs that we have available for multiple myeloma have come about because of patient participation in these new drug trials. And progress in this area is absolutely critical. We cannot get new drugs approved. We can't make new drugs available unless patients are willing to participate in these trials. And I should point out that patients themselves can often benefit in these trials because they make these new drugs available to patients who otherwise might not be able to get them where they are located. So I would stress this, that it's to make further progress in the treatment of myeloma and all of the diseases we're talking about today, participation in clinical trials is critical. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Benzinger. Really, this is an exciting time, and also for highlighting the importance of clinical trials and participation in those trials. Thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Oliver Press, and Dr. Press is actually is a member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. He's a recipient of Dr. Penny E. Peterson Memorial Chair for Lymphoma Research, and he's professor of medicine, University of Washington, and co-chair NCI Lymphoma Steering Committee. And Dr. Press is going to address new research presented at ASH on lymphoma, disease-specific treatment updates, and the quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Press.
Thank you. My mission is to provide first a brief overview of lymphoma standard therapy so that the new exciting treatments that were presented at the American Society of Hematology meeting will be more understandable. First of all, lymphoma is a cancer of the immune system of a type of cell called a lymphocyte. And when mutations occur in these lymphocytes, they proliferate too much, and you wind up with enlarged lymph nodes and often involvement also of the bone marrow and the spleen. There are about 75,000 new cases of lymphoma each year in the United States, and there are about 500,000 patients living with lymphoma in the United States at this time. It's a very complicated disease. There are, in fact, over 60 different types of lymphomas caused by different mutations. Some of these lymphomas are fast-growing, some are slow-growing. The treatments for the different types are different, and some of the lymphomas are more curable than others. And therefore, it's very important for a patient to know what kind of lymphoma they have, particularly when comparing the treatments they're receiving or the outcomes they have with other patients who have lymphoma. The standard workup for lymphoma involves a variety of blood tests, CAT scans, PET scans, and a bone marrow, and that allows one to assign a stage. That means how far the disease has spread, and that information is used to design therapy. The standard therapies now really depend both on the type of lymphoma and the stage, and because I can't talk about all 60 types, I'll talk in some generalities. And I'll talk first about the standard therapy for aggressive lymphomas. The most common type of lymphoma in the United States is called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. About 30% of all lymphomas are this type. And the standard treatment is a five-drug combination called R-CHOP, which has an antibody, rituximab, as well as four chemotherapy drugs. And it's usually given every 3 weeks for up to 6 to 8 cycles, depending on the circumstance. The other major type of lymphoma are so-called indolent or slow-growing lymphomas, and there are a variety of those, including follicular lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, and lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma. And together, these slow-growing or indolent lymphomas make up about 40% of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. The standard treatment for indolent lymphoma is hard to define because many patients don't need any treatment at all for a few years and are followed with just watchful waiting. Other patients might be treated with rituximab antibody alone, and still others with more extensive disease will receive rituximab along with various chemotherapies, including RCVP, R-CHOP, or R-bendamustine. So that's sort of a standard framework with which to talk about the new treatments. And I'm going to mention five different new exciting treatments that came up this year at our annual meeting. And the first category of new treatments are antibody drug conjugates. You've already heard a bit about this from Dr. Morrow for the leukemias. There are also exciting new antibody drug conjugates that target lymphoma cells. And there were two very impressive presentations, one with an antibody drug conjugate that sticks to a molecule on the surface of lymphoma called CD22, and another one binding to a molecule called CD79B. These molecules are on both aggressive and indolent B-cell lymphomas, and therefore they are broadly applicable. And there were some very exciting responses seen, even in patients who had not responded to a multitude of standard chemotherapy regimens. The other nice thing about these treatments is that they tend to have a lot fewer side effects than standard chemotherapy. There is some numbness and tingling in the fingers and the toes and a slight drop in the white count, but in general, these are less than with standard chemotherapy, making them attractive alternatives. There is also an antibody drug conjugate that's now been FDA approved for Hodgkin lymphoma and for T-cell lymphomas, which is called brentuximab vedotin. And at the meeting, there was an update combining this drug in T-cell lymphomas by Dr. Fanal at MD Anderson. And she showed that if you combined the CD30 antibody drug conjugate with standard chemotherapy, similar to CHOP, that 100% of patients had excellent responses and 88% had complete remission. So this was a very exciting development. The second group of new drugs I'll mention are so-called BCL2 inhibitors. BCL2 stands for B-cell lymphoma 2. It's a molecule which is overexpressed in many cancer cells, especially lymphoma cells, and it basically renders the cells immortal, so they don't die when they should die. And that's why the lymphoid cells pile up and you wind up with these enlarged lymph nodes. And there are now inhibitors of this molecule that down-regulate them and decrease the amount of BCL2 in cells. And these have led to some very exciting response rates. As a single agent, using it by itself, over 80% of patients with CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and small lymphocytic lymphoma had improvement in lymph node size. So it's a very exciting development and is also applicable to many different kinds of lymphomas. A third group of drugs that was very exciting are the so-called PI3 kinase delta inhibitors. That's a pretty complicated term. It doesn't have an official name yet, although most people call it Cal-101, which is kind of a nickname. And here again, very exciting response rates have been seen in the majority of patients with small lymphocytic lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and mantle cell lymphoma. It's not FDA approved yet, but it certainly is very impressive. The fourth drug I'll mention is called ibrutinib. It is also an inhibitor of a tyrosine kinase called Bruton's tyrosine kinase. And a paper was presented by Nathan Fowler showing very impressive response rates with ibrutinib in a variety of different lymphoma types, including follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, CLL, and SLL. And then the fifth And final new treatment category I'll talk about are so-called CAR T cells. Now, Dr. Morrow also briefly mentioned this. It is an immunotherapy in which patients who haven't responded well to standard chemotherapy have their blood drawn, and the T lymphocytes from their blood are isolated out. T lymphocytes are supposed to help fight off cancer, but obviously in cancer patients they're not working adequately. And one can genetically modify the cells to make them recognize the cancer better. You do this in the laboratory. You grow up billions of the patient's own T lymphocytes that are now enhanced so that they can recognize and kill the tumor cells. And this has been a very exciting treatment for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, as Dr. Morrow mentioned, but is also applicable to most types of B-cell lymphoma. And Dr. June presented some studies where 9 of the 12 patients he treated with very difficult malignancies had objective remissions, and some of them were absolutely dramatic. So I think that this is a very sophisticated and very impressive new treatment that hopefully will become more widely available. I am going to now turn to the last topic that I was asked to address, and that is the issue of quality of life. Obviously, the goal that all of us have is to not just get rid of the cancer, but to do so in a manner that doesn't cause a lot of side effects or toxicity for the patient. And one of the nice things about many of the new treatments that Dr. Morrow, Dr. Benzinger, and I have talked about is that they are kinder and gentler than old-fashioned chemotherapy. The monoclonal antibodies generally have very few side effects compared to chemotherapy. And the antibody-drug conjugates focus the chemotherapy drugs that are attached to them specifically on the cancer cells so that there's much less exposure to normal tissues like the heart, the lungs, the kidney, and the liver, and that the drug is selectively deposited at the cancer site. So that's very exciting. And the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, ibrutinib, and similar agents also have relatively little toxicity, allowing them to be combined with other agents with relative impunity. And finally, I would say that there are some exciting new approaches that were presented at the national meeting, looking at the use of positron emission tomography or PET scanning as a means of deciding which patients need to get some radiation after initial chemotherapy and which ones can be spared the radiation. This is particularly pertinent to Hodgkin lymphoma, and some of the studies suggest that if the PET scan is negative after initial chemotherapy, that one could eliminate radiation that otherwise would be given. And this, of course, cuts down toxicity and cuts down the risk of later malignancies in life. So I think my time is used up, but I thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'll turn the program back to Carolyn Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Press. A wonderful presentation and really a lot of new information about lymphoma and updates that are very helpful to our participants. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Erin Columbus. Erin is an oncology social worker, and she is the program director of online services at Cancer Care. And Erin is going to go review with you the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as discuss support groups for people living with blood cancers. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Erin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this informative call today. As an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to talk a bit about the emotional and social impact of cancer and how Cancer Care can help you. When you're first diagnosed with cancer, it can be an extremely overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices that will have a major impact on your life, and you may not know where to turn. Talking to a cancer care social worker can help you to maximize the support you get from your healthcare team, especially in dealing with issues such as symptom management, finding out more about your treatment options, and basically learning how to navigate the system to get the best care possible. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're experienced in how a cancer diagnosis affects a person and their family and friends, and we're also trained to help patients and their loved ones manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that do arise. One of the most important things, I think, to acknowledge about the emotional impact of cancer is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways, from the loss of your independence, loss of energy levels due to fatigue, and in the big picture, the loss of the life that you had before cancer. And specifically for people living with blood cancers, there are often many complex emotions that may accompany the diagnosis due to the far-reaching and chronic nature of the disease, its treatment, and its side effects. These physical and emotional changes can often feel very difficult to manage. Additionally, it's caregivers who are often especially in need of counseling and support because watching a loved one change in these ways can be very painful. That's why it's important to have an outlet to acknowledge these losses and to have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and empathic. This can mean talking one-on-one with a cancer care social worker, or it can also happen in one of our support groups. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. Group members offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support, guidance, and practical advice. In fact, we are currently offering an online group for people with blood cancers, which begins on February 4th. This is a safe and confidential space where you might find commonality with others. If you're interested in participating in this particular online group, please visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information and instructions on how to register. Lastly, cancer can have a significant impact on your finances. And for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect of cancer. Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance for help with transportation to treatment or help with home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with the costs of cancer. While we may not be able to resolve all the problems you're facing right now, a cancer care social worker provides a listening ear and the ability to walk alongside you as you navigate this difficult experience. Many patients and caregivers find this to be a very reassuring and comforting service that can help you to feel less alone. So please feel free to contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673. Or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our supportive services. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Erin, for just a wonderful presentation about the services of cancer care that people can access for free and all the information about the support groups as well. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And, of course, if we don't get to your question, please just contact Cancer Care at the end of the call using our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. But nevertheless, let's try to take as many of them as possible now. So, Stephanie, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And Alice, we have a question from one of our online participants. Question for Dr. Press. With NH follicular lymphoma, can someone live many, many years without ever being treated as long as blood work and CAT scans remain good? And there are no symptoms like the night, sweats, fevers, weight loss, et cetera. And this question comes from Tina. Dr. Press, could you address that question?
Sure. I didn't catch the type of lymphoma, but I assume they're talking about indolent lymphoma, like a follicular lymphoma. And certainly it's possible for many patients to live many, many years, decades, in relatively good health. I have some patients who I followed for over 20 years and with watchful waiting. And some patients don't need treatment for years. Those are lucky patients. It's not the typical patient, but it certainly is possible.
Thank you. Stephanie, other questions?
We do have a question from Randy H. Your line is open.
Thank you so much. Very interesting and helpful information. As a 26-year cancer survivor suffering from the ongoing side effects from my treatments back in 1986, I'm curious these days how much consideration is given in the chaos of diagnosis and treatment recommendations with not exceeding the amount of treatment necessary to defeat the cancer without impacting long-term quality of life for our growing community of survivors. Thank you.
And Randy, that's an excellent question. Did you want to indicate the type of blood cancer you had, or is this a general question?
Just a general question, thanks.
General question. Okay, well, that's a general question that I'm going to ask. Well, Dr. Morrow, would you like to address that question to start with anyway, and we might have everybody else weigh in on it.
Well, sure. I think probably the biggest answer to that question is that we really don't like the way we had to treat cancer in years past, which was with medications that were injurious to the whole system, but which was exploiting the fact that the cancer cells divided more rapidly. You heard all of us speak about our efforts to try to find smarter therapies, targeted therapies, which are selectively kind of harmful to cancer cells rather than generally harmful and just more harmful to the cancer cell. That being said, it's still not perfect. There are side effects with even the newer generations of medications. But even with chemotherapy, we have gained a leg up with understanding how there are different differences in metabolism between different children. For example, really set the stage, and in adults, we often will measure levels of chemotherapy as we're administering them to adjust the doses. Stem cell transplant is a great example of that, because we really don't want to overshoot there. And so I think we're really making good strides. But you're right, we haven't a perfect system where we can avoid toxicity, and that's really the goal of our trials, is to very carefully extract just all of the benefit and hone in on the dose that is very acceptable and doesn't leave folks with long-term toxicities. You know, congratulations for being such a warrior in the earlier days of cancer chemotherapy. It probably was a lot different than it is today, and we're hopeful that we won't do as much collateral damage, unfortunately, as we had in the past.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Morrow. Thank you, Randy, for that question. And Dr. Bensinger, Dr. Press, did you want to add anything?
No, I think he said it very well.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. And Stephanie, a next question, please.
Our next question comes from Jerry C. Your line is open.
Yes. I have a mantle cell lymphoma. I'm in a relapse on it, and I'm getting two chemo treatments 2 days in a row every 3 weeks. You mentioned something about that a few months ago. And I just wonder, where is there a pill form called 42R or something like that that's becoming available? And thing that sort in the pill form in the making?
Well, this is Dr. Press. I guess the question's probably for me. I mean, there are many treatments for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. It sounds like you're probably getting bendamustine and rituximab now, which is a very good treatment for that. There are some oral medicines which are becoming available. I mentioned two of them in my list, ABT-199, the BCL-2 inhibitor, and Cal-101, which is a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor. Those are both very exciting new drugs. Unfortunately, they're not FDA approved yet, and so they're only available on clinical trials. So this is an example of what Dr. Benzinger said, that some of the most exciting and attractive treatments are only available on clinical trials, and so we would encourage participation.
Thank you. And another question from one of our participants, one of our online participants, and that is a person with multiple myeloma, Dr. Benzinger, and they're on a watch and wait stage, and they would like to know more about what to do early that might help now and maybe slow the progression. So this is a general question on multiple myeloma. Dr. Benzinger, could you address that?
Sure, I'd be happy to address it. So multiple myeloma can appear without the development of so-called CRAB symptoms. And a CRAB is a cute little acronym that stands for calcium, renal function, anemia, and bone disease. And so what it means is that patients can be diagnosed with clinical myeloma and yet not have clinical symptoms related to the disease. The current treatment paradigm is not to treat patients until they develop symptoms. And the reason for that is that earlier trials have not shown any overall benefit. By treating asymptomatic patients earlier, they don't seem to gain anything overall in the long run. Now, this paradigm is being challenged by several studies. There is a study that was done in Europe taking a group of asymptomatic patients who had high risk features. And you can predict for patients who will be likely to progress to symptomatic myeloma from asymptomatic stage based on several clinical parameters. And they took these high-risk patients and treated them with lenalidomide or Revlimid and dexamethasone. And they did show improved improvements in the prevention of progression to symptomatic disease. It's a little early to know if there's a survival advantage for this, but it is something being studied now. But currently, the standard is not to treat patients who are asymptomatic and simply to watch them.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. Was there any new research presented at ASH regarding young adults with lymphoma for Dr. Press? It's a general question.
Well, you know, we usually plan our treatments not by age, but by the type of lymphoma. As I mentioned, there are like 60 different kinds. And so it's much more important to plan the treatment based on the type of lymphoma and the stage, that is how far it spread, rather than the age of the patient. Now, there are some circumstances, if patients are very elderly and frail, we often will attenuate doses. Patients who are young, like in their 20s, can usually stand fairly strong treatments. We are, of course, very cognizant in young people about late side effects. That is, particularly for something like Hodgkin lymphoma, we are now using smaller doses of radiation therapy and fewer cycles of chemotherapy to try to prevent some of the late complications that can happen 20 or 30 years later, like early coronary artery disease or second malignancies. But trials usually aren't designed just around age group. It's usually around diagnosis.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Press. Excellent. And we have another question about the pros and cons of Metoport placement and the side effects of Metoports. And Dr. Morrow, could you address that? That's, again, a general question.
Sure. Well, there are different ways of getting intravenous access. A simple IV can be placed. There are actually longer-term IVs called peripherally inserted central catheters or PICC lines, which is a good option as well, only because they're a little less complicated to put in. It's the essentially a long IV, and fairly easy to get out, and they can last for several weeks. I think the question was about a Metaport, which is something that the main advantage of it is the infection risk, and the complexity of it is a lot lower because it's something that's under the skin, and the small procedure is performed around the collarbone, and a reservoir with a small tube into one of the large veins there is placed surgically, and that requires a bit of circumstances. It needs to be done safely and does have a bit of risk, but once it's there, patients have a lot more freedom and can often, they can shower and swim and not worry about managing the catheter on a day-to-day basis. It does need to be flushed and taken care of like any other access device. I recommend it for my patients who I think may need access for a longer time in that they and in whom perhaps if it had to be removed and then a mini operation needed to be repeated, it wouldn't be a very risky procedure. So I think if someone needs intensive therapy for a shorter period of time and they might have, for example, very low blood counts or high infection risk for the short to medium term, some of the other catheters, which are can be removed without surgery, are a bit safer. But it's a great option, and many of my patients are very happy once they have it. It's the hardest thing to decide is to go ahead and do it, but it saves people from getting poked.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. And we have another question from one of our online participants. What are the risks of secondary cancers with multiple myeloma treatments, maintenance, and particularly bisphosphonates? Dr. Bensinger?
Well, there is a risk of second primary cancers just by virtue of the fact that you have multiple myeloma. So there appears to be about a twofold risk in secondary cancers just by that diagnosis, meaning that if a patient gets myeloma, they are more susceptible to other cancers. I'm not aware of any data that shows that the risk is increased with the use of the bisphosphonates. These are the bone protective drugs such as pimidronate and zoledronate. There is some data suggesting that maintenance lenalidomide can increase the risk of secondary primary cancers by another twofold over the baseline risk. But that is the only data that I'm aware of that shows that patients with myeloma have an increased risk over and above their baseline risk.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really just been exceptional in today's program. It's just really been an extraordinary program, and it's also been a very ambitious program to cover a major meeting and to cover three different types of blood cancers, and I think you've done just an extraordinary job. I want to thank all of you who've asked questions on the phone and also queued up and asked them online as well, because you really enhanced our program today. I want to remind all of you this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So first of all, I do want to say that if you did not get to ask your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff are here to, of course, help you with your questions and to get answers to them. In addition, I just want to remind all of you also that Cancer Care offers a host of services for you to access all the time. And those continue when this program concludes. And so I want to remind all of you about those services. We have a staff of over 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we had to provide a host of services. And all of those services are free. We offer practical and financial assistance. We offer counseling services, a chance to talk to someone about your concerns. We offer support groups, which Aaron talked about, both support groups on the telephone and online. We also have these workshops that we offer regularly, as well as publications and fact sheets that we offer. So do take advantage of all these services. And most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with blood cancer or with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And so I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.